Hi, I'm Andy Brownfield, and this is Above the Fold. In today's episode, we'll be talking about two big news stories in Hamilton County. First, the county is looking for office space for 1,200 workers outside of its existing downtown office. And second, a Mount Washington bookstore is closing after just more than a year in business. We'll talk to some of the people involved in these stories and get their thoughts on what they mean for the county. So stay tuned for that and more in today's episode of Above the Fold. Thanks for listening. That sounded a little different than our normal podcast intro. This is Above the Fold, the podcast by the Cincinnati Business Courier, and I'm your host, Andy Brownfield. I'm joined by Business Courier Editor-in-Chief Tom Demaropoulos. Hey, Tom.
Good morning, Andy.
So inspired by, or maybe blatantly ripping off, Alec Baldwin in his podcast, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, I had Bard, Google's AI answer to ChatGPT, write the intro to our podcast. Leaves a little bit to be desired, don't you think?
It was fine. It could have been punchier.
Yeah, for one, it got some things wrong. I mean, we're not going to be interviewing the people involved in the stories teased above, but, and forgive me for tooting my own horn, it does lack some of the creativity and intrigue of an intro I would write. But like the iPhone and the internet before it, ChatGPT and generative artificial intelligence could represent a seismic shift in all industries, including ours.
Yes, and as you know this about me, Andy, change can be scary for me. So I don't love the idea of AI coming in and changing the way we've done things for years and years.
Yeah, and given that so much of our profession is, you know, news is kind of split into two segments. There's reporting a story, going out and talking to the right sources, finding the correct documents, public records, and then there's writing the story. And I don't think AI is going to be able to do anything at all when it comes to reporting. But when writing, I don't know. I mean, I don't think we can rebottle this genie.
I agree. Things are moving too fast to stop now.
Yeah, and like, you know, like the internet before it or the iPhone, I guess I'm really going to glom onto this internet thing. I mean, prior to the advent of the internet, which I guess neither of us were around for journalism pre-internet, but effective reporters knew they had a Rolodex. They knew the right people to call to get the right information. They had access to microfiche and were able to look up background for stories involved in that. And then when the internet came around, when Google came around, you could Google that information. Those skill sets became obsolete.
To an extent, yes. You know, I don't know how many reporters are still running down to the library to look up documents to find out a stat on something, to figure out, you know, which city actually was built earlier. Was it Frankfurt or Munich or, you know, whatever the, you know, whatever you can Google now and get an answer in microseconds. You used to have to go and find an encyclopedia or a research book.
Yeah, so I think journalists of the future or journalists of the very near future are going to be people who might, I don't know, find some ethical way to utilize these generative AI models effectively in that kind of way that assists in their work and not replaces it. Because I think you run into all kinds of really sticky issues about copyright, plagiarism, that kind of thing when a news organization publishes stories that are created by AI.
Yeah. Who do you go to if it's something's inaccurate?
Exactly. The editors. Us. So one thing the chatbot wasn't lying about was Hamilton County is indeed seeking new office space for 1,200 of its employees. And what it's looking for, according to a request for proposals, is awfully specific.
Yes. This reads like they've got a very good idea of kind of what they're looking for exactly. And it's a big ask, Andy. This is a lot of employees that they're looking to move to a different location.
Yeah, for context, Hamilton County has about 4,400 employees in total, and most of them do work in the urban basin. Now, here's where things start to get a little bit on the nose. About 1,200 of those employees work for the county commissioners. Now, others work for the county's other elected officers, the sheriff, prosecutor, clerk of courts, recorder, coroner, treasurer, auditor, and engineer. But it kind of, I don't know, I'm not going to put words in their mouth, but the two numbers do match up awfully specifically. So Hamilton County is looking for between 350,000 to 400,000 square feet of Class A office space, and they want it within 7 miles of the county courthouse. They're looking for a lease of 11 years with two options for five-year renewals, and they want each floor to have a maximum of 90,000 square feet. This new office also has to be within two or three blocks of I-71, 74, 75, or the Norwood Lateral, and along a Metro bus line. And it's got to have at least 1,200 on-site parking spaces and access to another 350.
I think of all of those requirements, Andy, the one that is going to be the toughest if we're talking about keeping these jobs downtown is the parking. Where do you put 1,200 employees' cars if you need them in one area?
It's impossible. Not downtown.
Yeah. You can put them at the banks, but, you know, at the banks you're not always paying the same rate. If there's a Reds Day game that kind of supersedes the regular parking down there, there's enough spaces, but not for consistent daily parking.
Yeah. So we talked earlier about how a big part of reporting is sourcing and knowing the people who know the stuff. And Chris Wetterick, he spoke with some real estate sources who seem to believe that this RFP could be pointing to the old Bon Secours, not the old, the current Bon Secours Mercy Health headquarters in Bond Hill.
Yes. You know, according to Chris's story, he kind of was able to determine that currently that building is not being used to its full capacity. The building was built for about 1,500 employees, and it sounds like about 150 are using it on a daily basis. This is kind of the new reality post-pandemic, that office space is not being used as often or the same way it was previously. So, you know, potentially Mercy, you know, Bon Secours Mercy Health might be looking at all their space and going, well, if somebody else wants it to use all the time, it might make sense for us to sublease our space and, you know, only take a portion of it or locate to a different location. There's lots of different options that could play out here.
Yeah, and Chris will be on top of all the developments. So speaking of parking, I love coming to Over the Rhine for dinner, for bar hopping, or even for the very little recreational shopping that I do. The absolutely minimal recreational shopping that I do. But parking has to be the worst part of the experience, don't you think?
I would agree. You know, as a suburbanite, I love my parking. I love an easy parking place. But I get it's the trade-off of a vibrant, active downtown and neighborhood like Over the Rhine is that, well, everyone wants to be there. So that's why there's so many cars there.
Yeah, it's just the older I get, the harder it is for me to leave my little Norwood bubble to go to Pepin Dolores or Quanhapa when I know I got to drive 15 minutes and then spend another 5 minutes searching for parking. So a near ban on new surface lots in downtown and other parts of the urban core is set to expire on September 20th, and Councilman Mark Jeffries wants to extend that another 6 months. So the extension is supposed to allow Cincinnati's planning staff to study a permanent ban. New surface lots are currently banned downtown in parts of the East End, Mount Adams, Mount Auburn, Pendleton, Over the Rhine, and the West End. Now, you can still build new surface lots, but they have to be approved by the Cincinnati Planning Commission first. And these new lots have been banned since September 2022, so the upcoming deadline Jeffries is looking to extend marks one full year from that construction having been halted. There are currently 39,000 parking spaces and garages and surface lots downtown, and city zoning is looking to see what the long-term impact of banning any more surface lots would be. Not to say there couldn't be more construction of parking garages, but I think the idea is that land is underutilized as just a clear-cut parking lot.
Yeah, and that's kind of what this is really getting to, Andy, is that surface lots are not viewed as the highest and best use for that property in the urban core. And, you know, we've been talking about with the redevelopment of, or I should say the construction of the Companion Bridge, kind of this idea that we might be able to get additional acreage to the west of downtown. There's still a lot of opportunity to redevelop in the city if you're willing to remove surface parking. So it's finding a way to use the existing land that's in the urban core at its highest and best use. And a lot of times, you know, that could include multi-use on one site. So parking, retail, office, maybe more likely residential.
Yeah. So in a dense urban city like Cincinnati, it's kind of best to build up instead of just clear cut, or at least that's what Jeffries is saying. And this is, this extension is not without opposition. So Chavez Properties is one of the largest owners of parking lot interests throughout the region, and Martin Chavez II, who's the asset manager for the company, said 12 months is plenty of time for the city to have been studying this, and they should make a decision already.
That does seem like 12 months seems like a long time to be studying this topic. I get it's important. It's, we should get this right, but he does have a point that 12 months seems like it's long enough to have come to a decision on what they should be doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have loved to add 12 months to study anything in college. So, Tom, you built your house, right?
I did. It'll be 10 years ago in December that we moved in.
So my wife Hannah and I, we spent like 8 months in the buying process. We put in multiple offers, we got into a bidding war or two, and then we finally bought our house in Norwood in 2019. And if I'm being entirely honest with you, if we had not spent like 8 months just slogging through the process, we might have been a bit more particular. But we bought our house in 2019, and things only got crazier from there. And it looks like they haven't exactly slowed down price-wise, despite the rising interest rates.
Yeah, Andy, I'll tell you, even in 2013, that's why we ended up building, because so we were looking at houses, and what would happen is every weekend we would have five or six homes that we wanted to go look at, and by the time we would drive to the homes, they'd be under contract. We were like, we are never, like, we don't have jobs where we can just stop what we're doing immediately. My wife and I, neither of us can just stop immediately what we're doing and go look at a house. So we were like, this is silly. We're never going to be able to find a house. We need to go, we'll just go build one, because we can control that process a lot better. Yeah, and since then it's continued. It's just ramped up. The demand has ramped up, and at the same time, the inventory has decreased.
Yeah, if new homes stopped hitting market today, we'd have 28 days of inventory left, and that's bonkers.
It is, especially when you look at the historic average of the inventory. A balanced market, which is a market that's, you know, about even for a buyer and a seller, is considered 5.5 to 6 months. So to have 28 days, you know, this leads to things like, you throw out inspections, you know, or you can have an inspection, but it's just for the buyer's interest, or just so they know this is what they're getting into. The seller's not going to do anything about it. It's why you have so many cash offers. You have just so much competition for these homes right now.
Yeah, and that competition's pushing prices up, and Cincinnati home sales saw the largest year-over-year price increase in the U.S. in April, according to RE/MAX. They jumped 8.4% over April 2022. Now, the median sale price was $275,000, though, so that's still significantly lower than the median sale price for the largest 49 metropolitan areas across the nation, which was $409,000. So, Cincinnati, you're paying more, but you're still paying less than other cities.
Yes, Cincinnati is still a deal, comparatively.
Yeah. So when's the last time you went into a brick-and-mortar bookstore?
The last time I went to a brick-and-mortar bookstore was Matt and Joy's in Over the Rhine, and it was last October.
Wait, were you shopping for a gift? Or?
I was picking up a couple Christmas gifts.
Yeah. So I love bookstores. Back in my pre-21 years, I used to just wander Borders or Barnes & Noble, excited by the possibilities of where all these books could take me. Actually, at one point, I read most of, if not the entire young adult section of the Mount Washington Public Library. Then I minored in English and read the Canterbury Tales too many times, and I don't think I read another book for the next 4 years after college. In the age of Amazon, though, it's kind of a man-bites-dog story to see a brick-and-mortar bookstore pop up, but that's what Jeremy Clark, a local author who published the Palace Program trilogy, did in Mount Washington. Unfortunately, it lasted a little bit more than a year before he had to close. So Clark opened the Tome in the heart of what you might generously call Mount Washington's business district on Beachmont Avenue. Now, I grew up there. I worked 7 years at that Kroger, and I would love to see the kind of thoughtful development in Mount Washington, which I kind of claim as my home neighborhood, that's gone on in other neighborhoods. And the Tome was a step in the right direction. So in April, Clark, he launched a Kickstarter seeking to keep the doors open. He cited a lack of local support, and he was trying to reach a $50,000 goal. But unfortunately, with 92 backers, only about $6,500 was raised.
Yeah, Andy, this is a little bit of a bummer to lose something like that helps, you know, b- bookstores, I think, along with, you know, coffee shops and restaurants and neighborhood bars, are the types of retail uses that help build a community. You know, you get to bump into your neighbors, you get to run into people who are visiting your neighborhood to see those types of things. So it's sad to see this this closing.
And the Tome was kind of that third place. It had a full-service coffee shop with drip coffee, espresso, and tea, and a coffee subscription service where customers could buy beans in bulk and have them shipped to their homes. The Tome hosted a literary program, writing classes, workshops for all ages, including classes specialized for children. It's not over, though. So when Clark made the announcement on Facebook that the Tome was going to be closing, he said he's going to make another announcement in 30 to 60 days about the decision. About the future of the Tome. He said that a decision has not yet been made on a location for the comeback, but he has a healthy number of options under consideration. So a lot of things get locked into place in your teenage years. I still feel like I'm the same person I was at the age of 17. Only now my knees pop when I get out of bed, and my neck hurts if I sleep funny. I don't know about you, Tom, but when I was a teenager, Newport-on-the-Levee was the cool place to hang out on evenings and weekends.
Yes. I can't tell you how many times I would go and see a movie and get Cold Stone Creamery down at Newport-on-the-Levee.
And then tip, so they had to sing.
Yes.
That's a really creative way to get people to tip you, is to public humiliation in exchange for tips.
So North American Properties, they bought Newport-on-the-Levee in 2018, and over the next 3 years, they poured $100 million into overhauling the entertainment complex.
And the newest tenant at the overhauled Newport-on-the-Levee is 16 Lots Southern Outpost, which just opened on May 19th. 16 Lots is a Mason craft brewery that dates back to 2017, and for their first foray over the river, they're taking 10,700 square feet, which is a pretty sizable space in Newport-on-the-Levee, and that includes 3,000 square feet of patio space and a cigar lounge. It's got a nautical theme, kind of think 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, but with nods to Cincinnati's riverboat past. And they kind of built up a rock star team of people there. I mean, there's Cat O'Connell, who was one of the founders of Copper and Flame and Over the Rhine, a supremely underrated restaurant. Kobe Bowman, who was running the kitchen at Royce and by all measures was turning that place around before the Amaranth Hospitality Group out of Nashville shut it down. And there's Chris Mitchell, who was the founding brewer of Woodburn Brewing in East Walnut Hills, and who was the head distiller, head winemaker, and head brewer of the OTR Stillhouse at Knox Joseph Distillery in Over the Rhine. So it's a pretty stacked team there.
It's a team of Avengers right there.
Yeah. So I think it just goes to show just what a big draw Newport-on-the-Levee has become. I mean, they're joining places like a Lego-themed brickery cafe and play, a new upcoming food hall galley on the levee, Amador Cuban restaurant, which just opened, and barbecue restaurant Shiners on the levee, not to mention places like Immersive Game Box, which is like a VR concept where three of the walls in this room are projection-mapped lights and just interactive games you can play with virtual reality headsets, which is right up my alley.
Yeah, Andy, North American Properties has, you know, when they bought the levee, they said they had ambitious goals for that property. They wanted to turn it into what, you know, they thought it could be, and they're well on their way to getting to that kind of that finish line.
Yeah, no longer just a place for high schoolers to hang out at Hot Topic and the AMC. Pat McMullen is the kind of guy you want to come in to fix up your company. He's the CEO of Fast Growing Graphic Village, and he's held a number of top leadership roles at firms coming from the financial side, where he helped turn them around and in some cases prepare them for acquisition. He talks with us about how print is not dead, and why Graphic Village just sponsored David Letterman's IndyCar. This is Pat McMullen on Buffer Fold. All right. So, Pat, you were saying just before we started that, you know, in the middle, as the pandemic hit and business kind of dried up for you guys because nobody's having events, nobody's having weddings. You know, how did you guys weather that? How'd you take that?
For us, when COVID hit, there was a big downturn in the industry when people weren't having events. Sporting events were canceled. School was canceled. And a lot of the things that we print for kind of dried up. So we had two different options. One option was the option of cut back and just scale down, lay off people, do those kinds of things. And that was something we certainly wanted to avoid. The second option was just to go all in, and that's what we decided to go with. So the all in option involved going out and finding some very, very good people that were available in the marketplace, bringing them all on board. We found a couple of very, very good companies that were available because of the pandemic where owners had said, enough, I'm done, just going to walk away from this. We brought those into the fold and added some very good equipment. And the plan was that as COVID ended, it was going to be an event, had a start, had an end. When that end came about, we were going to be strong and we were going to hit the market hard. And it's an approach that either goes very, very well or very, very poorly. For us, they went very well. So we were fortunate that we made the right choice and we're coming out of this strong and hitting the market hard now in the Cincinnati area.
You guys were kind of on a tear before that happened. I mean, Graphic Village had been growing huge. And so what, take me back to March 2020 and when you heard like public life was kind of shutting down, what was your reaction?
Our first reaction was, well, we have to make some kind of adjustment here. What we've always done in the past is not going to work here, at least in the short term going forward. And so as we thought through that adjustment, we took a look at some of the programs that were out there to encourage you to keep your employees around and thought that that really is the right way to go. We have people to take care of, and when COVID's over, we want every single one of these people as part of our organization. We got to keep our team together. So we kind of hunkered down and cut some expenses and went all in on the people. Kept all of our staff on, and even added staff during that. But there was kind of a panic phase at first where you know that there's going to be reductions in work, but you find different opportunities. We started looking at different markets. We started looking at some COVID-related PPP and their PPE equipment and those kind of things that were other opportunities that found their way during COVID. But we knew it was an event with a start and an end, and we hoped that it was a short event and that we would weather it and come out strong, and that's kind of what we did.
Now, Graphic Village is more than 100 years old. For our listeners who might not be familiar, tell us a bit about what you do.
Sure. Graphic Village is the largest print marketing provider in the Cincinnati region. So our print marketing services, the idea of the village is that we want people to be able to get all of their print marketing services under one roof. So the idea is that we would have everything from the earliest steps of it, which is branding, logo creation, those kinds of things, up through the print production, the distribution, mailing, signage, all those kinds of pieces. So what we've tried to do is build a village, which is in the name, just because we want it to be easy for customers to work for us. We want to be the one-stop shop where we can make this work for them. They can come to Graphic Village, get all of their print marketing needs under one roof, and we just strive every day just to be the ones that are easy to work with, that do very, very high-quality, quick-turn work for them.
So Pat, where would people see your products? Where would, you know, what would be a good, you know, what would be a good point to say that was us?
We do one of the projects that we do that's high profile is for Applebee's, and in many of the Applebee's chains around the countries, we do a whole lot of the signage and things that you would see when you walk in. So if you see a lot of the alcohol advertising, those kinds of cutout things, we would have done a lot of that. Most people are familiar with the mural on the side of Channel 48 that we did of Dr. Odell Owens. So that was a piece of our work that's very recognizable locally. We do a lot of work with Paycor. So if you get mailings and things like that from Paycor, that's a very large client. Cintas. So a lot of the high-profile companies here in town are ones that work with us. Often you'll get a piece of direct mail at home. You'll get something from a front gate or one of those. And those are pieces that we've done. And it's kind of neat when you go to your mailbox and out there is a piece that's recognizable. And you can say, yeah, I printed that. We printed that last week.
Yeah, we kind of get the same feeling. Like I can see one of our book of lists right there in the it's not a nightstand, but a little end table next to you. Or this is one of us too.
Sure.
So you've got a background and your education is in finance. How did you wind up at Graphic Village?
I started my career in public accounting. And to me, public accounting, if you want to be a good technical finance and accounting guy, is the place to start. So I spent about 9 years in public accounting, really to me learning the nuts and bolts of finance and to be a good partner for a business. I knew all along I didn't want to be a public accountant for my whole life, but I wanted that technical training and the real ability. It also gave me a chance to go back and get my CPA license and to get my master's degree. So I felt like I was ready then to go out and be a real asset to someone. When I left public accounting, I got into some vision insurance, managed vision insurance, something I knew absolutely nothing about. But I was able to take the finance skills and realize that those finance skills transition very well business to business. So over time, I've moved into a couple different industries. I've done the vision insurance I spoke about, worked for about 15 years in the pet space, and doing very similar to what I'm doing at Graphic Village. We look for very good companies to build, bought them, rolled it up into a bigger organization, sold the organization three different times, and then decided it was time to move on. It became a public company, and it was time for me to move on. That wasn't my interest. So then I did the same in a commercial door space, again, switching to an industry I knew absolutely nothing about. But if you know how to buy and sell businesses and evaluate them, it's something that, regardless of product, transfers pretty well. After doing the commercial door business, we were going through a sale process and working 100 hours a week for months, and just kind of through the sale was just kind of done. You're burned out. You need a break. So took a break for a while, and then I was fortunate enough to meet Eric Kahn. And Eric has been doing this roll-up in the printing space since 2012 here in Cincinnati. And his skills and interests align very, very closely with mine. So at the time, I came in as CFO to help him kind of oversee his investment group, the Revitalized Capital Group. And from there, shortly after, our CEO left. And so I had the opportunity to become the CEO and day-to-day run Graphic Village, but at the same time, spend a lot of time with Eric. And we really enjoy sitting around looking at opportunities. We do a lot of M&A together, and we're very close friends, so it works for us every day.
So what kind of drew you to finance in the first place? Because I'm just thinking of my own high school career and just the things I was interested in. I probably wanted to do the least work possible, and I was good at writing, which ChatGPT is now, turning into no longer a viable career path. So what kind of attracted you to that?
I had a very good friend. I worked at the YMCA when I was in high school and early college, and he was a partner in an accounting firm. And he kept saying, he said, the quality of life here is just great. He said, you have to be hardworking, you work hard, but there's just tons of rewards in it. And it seemed to be the path to being a CEO or CFO of an organization. That's what I always wanted to do. So to me, the CEO's right-hand guy is always the CFO. And if you want to be the CEO, you need to be the right-hand guy of the person that is in that chair. Mm-hmm. So over time, I kind of aspired to that. I was talking to Mark on the way down and talking about when I went to Amelia High School. I'm a Cincinnati guy. I grew up here. And the theme of our graduation speaker when I went to Amelia High School was, even though you guys went to a country school that's not a very good school, you still have a chance. And I remember from that day forward telling him, I'm going to show this guy, not only do I have a chance, but I'm going to make something of my education from Amelia High School. And that was kind of a challenge to me. I'll never forget that day when he told us that you still can succeed. It's not too late. It's a very bizarre graduation speech.
Right, not the most inspiring. Have you looked that guy up since?
I have followed him a little bit. And no, I have not circled back with him. But it did inspire me anyway to get out there and try to do the best that I possibly could. So
I was going to say there can be different ways of being motivated, and that seems like a different one that ended up being quite the motivator.
It was. It was an interesting approach, and it was probably not that well received at the time. But there were other people, too, from that school that did succeed. And obviously, I mean, if you're going to succeed, it's going to come from having good parents, good family. You have to have I have a great wife at home that takes care of the home front, which allows me to travel, allows me to work long hours, and you can't do it without that. So you need that support, but that little bit of motivation helped. I mean, I'll never forget that speech.
Yeah. So I think last time we talked, you guys had just signed a IndyCar sponsorship. What drew you guys to that area of sport, and what does that all entail?
The IndyCar, I would say that the IndyCar relationship we have now is probably one of the most rewarding and most enjoyable things I've done in my career. There are a lot of sports fans in our office, and I'm certainly one of them. The motorsports fans are an interesting crowd. They're very loyal. They're just a really interesting, different group of people. And we added a person to our team that had worked with the Ray Hall team and with IndyCar for quite a while. He made the introduction with me to that organization, and it was right away, it was just a natural fit. It was something that we super enjoy, and to me, the workday is long enough that I'm not going to spend it with people I don't enjoy being with. If we have a client or someone that I don't enjoy spending time with, I just don't have time for that. So when they brought in the indie stuff, they bring you in as a family, so you're part of the family immediately. So when you go there, Bobby Ray Hall will come put his arm around you, tell you, thanks for coming. It's great having you and my family. You meet his son, Graham, who's still a current Indy driver. They make sure that you're down there just being a part of the whole thing. And to me, it's been the most rewarding part so far of my career, to be honest with you. And I think it's going to take off. It's going to be a good business relationship and something that we look forward to really growing in the future.
So were you an IndyCar fan before this?
I was a motorsports fan, but not as much, probably not as much motorsports as the other local sports. I grew up a Cincinnati guy. So for me, from the time I was two, we were watching Reds baseball, Bengals football, and UC basketball. And so I've always been a huge Cincinnati fan. The motorsports stuff is a bit new to me, but we took to it quickly, and I really, really enjoy it. It's something totally different.
Yeah, my dad took me down, me and my brother, down to the Kentucky Motor Speedway when we were little, and I think the thing that I remember most about that experience is like having to wear earplugs just because it's so deafeningly loud with all these huge engines going around. What do you even know? Because I know that Formula One is really big right now. It seems to be exploding in popularity. I'm not sure I know the difference between IndyCar and Formula One.
The IndyCar guys are, it's obviously open wheel racing. So you have NASCAR, which is stock car racing. You have IndyCar, which is open wheel. The guys on the IndyCar circuit are still fueling their cars. The guys on Formula One, when they come in for a pit stop on Formula One, they're typically in 2.5 seconds, just a very quick tire change, flip it in, flip it out. And they're also mostly doing road courses. So almost everything you're doing on Formula One is just road courses where they've blocked off streets and run the races that way. IndyCar does do some of those races, but they also are on tracks very often. So when you go to an event like the Indy 500, the Indy 500 in Indianapolis holds 450,000 people. I mean, it's the biggest sports venue in the world. And there's nothing like an event like that. I mean, you see just the bank of the track and the noise and the crowd, and you realize there's 450,000 super enthusiastic people at this event. And to me, there's nothing like that. The road course stuff is interesting. Indy also does quite a few road courses during the year. But Formula One is predominantly on road courses and Le Mans and other places.
So then with Graphic Village's sponsorship of this, is it a racing team?
It is a racing team. We are sponsored. We are with a team that is Rahal, Letterman, and Lanigan. So Bobby Rahal won the actual Indy 500 in 1986. His son Graham is a very, very successful racer to this day. They have a team of three drivers. For Indy, they're hoping to put in a fourth driver, so they've added Catherine Legg. We're going to have four drivers this time. And it is a team. It's a team that has two components. One part of the team is the Honda Racing team, and they're the ones that do the IndyCar side. And then they have a BMW performance team, and that's a really interesting endurance race. And these guys will switch in and out. They'll do a 24-hour race and see how many miles you can do. Four drivers are going to jump in and out of the BMW. So when you talk about a team, it truly is a team. There's a full team of Honda engineers tuning these cars and every week making the adjustments. There's four drivers that are driving for them. And then you've got the past drivers and a whole support team of, you wouldn't believe the work that goes into pit crews and engineering and aerodynamics and stuff you'd never think. Just trainers. Everybody's in the gym every day training with a personal trainer.
Oh, wow.
And the stuff you never think of the support around that.
Right. You wouldn't really think that you need to hit the gym to sit behind the wheel of a car.
It's unbelievable when you watch. I mean, sometimes when you watch the races, they'll even show the heart rate of these guys. They're at 165, 170 beats a minute.
Oh, jeez. Wow.
And it's intense. And you've often heard that the best athletes in the world, they have different ways of measuring, but they say that the best athletes in the world are the motocross riders, followed by these guys that drive the cars. And it is very, very intense.
Yeah, that's what I've always heard. It is an athletic event. Even though you're using a machine to augment your skills, you have to be in good shape. You have to be physically fit. You have to be an athlete to do it.
Yeah, and you have to be on your game the whole time. I mean, you are intensely concentrating for a couple of hour race, and it's tough. It's not like driving a regular car. I mean, you're in a car where your feet are absolutely straight out in front of you. You're strapped everywhere. You've got a helmet on. It's hot. It's hard. And it's a great sport. I didn't have the appreciation for it when I was younger, but after being really exposed to it recently, I actually love it. I think it's great.
Yeah, I drive a manual and it's just a Mazda, and I pretend sometimes when I'm shifting on the highway that I'm in a race car, but now I just feel like a fraud.
Yeah.
So there have been a lot of big sponsorship news in Cincinnati recently with Paycor Stadium and the Gold Star Skyline swap for the official chili of the Cincinnati Bengals. What attracted you to this kind of sponsorship in motorsports? I mean, what made that an attractive proposition for Graphic Village?
For us, the Rahal team has a lot of other very, very good sponsors, and they're companies that we very much would like to do business with. And so when you become a sponsor, you're part of this family. So you get to meet all the other people, you're meeting the decision makers, and you're meeting other people that are motorsports enthusiasts. So it becomes an easy conversation to move in, and we'll get an announcement from Bobby Rahal saying these guys are the preferred print marketing supplier, and I prefer you use them. And so it gives us an entree to a whole bunch of customers that otherwise it would be very, very difficult to find your way into. And through this partnership, we give back to them, and then they give back to us through these relationships we're able to make. And you also look forward to seeing them at the events. So we see these guys at the events, and we'll figure out who's coming beforehand and do that kind of stuff. But, I mean, they're your friends and family as well.
So. Yeah, it sounds like a much more tactical sponsorship than something like the Bengals, where the main draw would just be to the average consumer out there seeing the two brands associated with each other.
Right. We've also been doing a lot of promotion of those kinds of sponsorships recently. So Paycor is a very, very good customer of ours, and we help them kind of amplify their message, because it doesn't do a lot of good to do that sponsorship if you don't get the word out. And so we're doing a lot of things with them to help them capitalize on getting the word out that Paycor is a Bengal sponsor. We do a lot of co-branding and things where we're able to do apparel with Paycor pieces on it as well as Bengal pieces. And we keep telling those folks that it doesn't do a lot of good to do this and pay the money if you're not going to capitalize on it. And we can help them do that. The same with Skyline. Skyline's a very good customer for us. And the licensing is incredibly complex. We're fortunate enough to have the person that wrote the original NFL license and the NFL HL license on staff. And literally hand wrote them years ago. And so Jim Sims is about 80 years old. No one knows it better than him. He's come on staff, and so when people want to work with the NFL, work with the NHL, we have the authority there that's able to not only tell them what the rules are and how it works, but also call the NFL and immediately have his call taken.
Yeah.
Where with you and I, that probably wouldn't happen.
No, we've tried. Yeah. Yeah, Joe Burrow, if you want to come on the podcast, still waiting. So we I guess, work in tangentially connected industries. Newspaper, we've been hearing that, you know, print is dying, print is dead for a long time. But in your industry, kind of how does that looking right now? I mean, what's kind of the temperature of the industry?
It's kind of interesting. You hear that a lot, and it goes through waves. There's times when people say it's going to go full digital, everything is digital. I think most people have become immune to a lot of that digital advertising. I don't know how many emails you get in your inbox a day, but I probably get 500, and I probably don't read 480 of them. And people are just blasting them and knocking them out. And so you can reach an awful lot of people that way, but it's not nearly as effective. So what we're finding is that to be effective in print, you need to have something that's different. People want something that's customized to them. So you want something that comes and says, hello, Andy, and has some information about you. It should have some touch and feel to it. So a lot of what we're doing is embellishing the pieces. We have it so it's got a tactile feel. And something, if you get something with a soft touch or with an embellishment on it, you're going to spend a little time with that piece. If you get a generic postcard, probably not so much. And so we're finding that during COVID, all the studies about direct mail were showing that it was super effective. People were at home. They were having no human contact. They were literally waiting for the mailman to show up and see what was in there. And so it was an odd kind of experience. But we've heard over and over that direct mail is dying out. It's just not the case. But you have to do it right. You have to customize it. You got to get it in the right hands. So it does me absolutely no good to get you a piece on house painting if you live in an apartment. But if I can say, Andy is a guy that owns a house, and he's actually even been searching for someone that likes to do house painting, and I can get you a piece that, hey, I'm a house painter, would you like to do this? Then you got a piece that you're going to react to. And so that's kind of where it's going. It's going from just generic print it and send it type direct mail to something very targeted and with a look and a feel that is something that's going to catch your attention. Excellent. It's certainly not dying, though.
All right. Let's hope our industry goes the same way. Well, Pat, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Oh, it's great to be here with you guys and meet both of you.
Thanks, Pat,
for having me.
Above the Fold is a podcast by the Cincinnati Business Courier, hosted by me, Andy Brownfield, and Tom Demaropoulos. The podcast is produced and edited by me, and our theme music was written by Dylan McCartney. Come back next week for another edition of Above the Fold.